The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, we've been talking about the attributes of the church, and we talked mainly about apostolicity and holiness on Wednesday, and we're talking more today about Catholicity and unity. I'm going to try to show you in a couple of ways that those attributes seem to go together. That is, apostolicity and holiness tend to interrelate pretty closely, just as Catholicity and unity. In fact, I'm going to try to graph a couple of things for you like I did last time when we're trying to use these attributes to test models. Actually, one of the ways to test a model of a church with the attributes, it's not the only way to do it. One of the ways to test a model of a church is to ask yourself, when you're listening to a model being delivered, for example, every time you read a book on here's what God's doing in our church, or every time you go to a seminar, you need to be testing the model. And you can be saying, is this person right? If this person is right, what attributes is he invoking? That's one question to ask. What attributes are invoked? And I'm going to try to give you an example of this if I get time today, just to give you a case study. But when you're looking at a church, you say, what attributes are being invoked? Very often, nowadays, the word philosophy of ministry in the American scene is very, very in vogue. And so people are trying to tell you, here's my philosophy of ministry. Now, that's always a very intriguing and interesting exercise. Ask somebody, what's your philosophy of ministry? If you want to get into the DMIN program at Westminster Seminary, you've got to write us a little short paper on what is your philosophy of ministry. And very often when a person writes down their philosophy of ministry, that's the easiest place for you to say, what attributes are being invoked? But then a second question is, what attributes are missing, you see? If you think the man is, or the person who is giving you this, is right, you say, what attributes are being invoked? And if you think there's something missing, you say, what attributes are missing? That's a very helpful way to go about it. In fact, maybe I'll ask you that question in about a half an hour, if I can get there. Okay? Now, let's talk about Catholicity and unity. Let me quickly review Catholicity, because we did talk about that at some length. Catholicity, we said, is ordinarily, in the Protestant understanding of it, our biblical theological understanding of it, Catholicity refers to the universality of the church. It refers to two kinds of universality, geographical and social. The reason this is important to keep in mind, my goodness, it's important to keep in mind, is that unlike other religions, two of which, the other two main monotheistic religions, Judaism and Islam, unlike those religions, Christianity is really, really culture free, in a sense. That is to say, both Judaism and Islam has a great deal of trouble really saying that our religion is for all cultures, that in every culture it comes in and it can be incarnated in its own culture. There's no doubt, for example, Orthodox Muslims would say that the Quran can't be translated, because it was written in Arabic and God speaks Arabic. And there's a great deal of emphasis on the need to, if you're really a Muslim, to take in a lot of the Arabic culture to really be Muslim and understand Islam. And Judaism is the same way. They have not been able, certainly, to bring Judaism into every tongue, tribe, people, and nation, because there's this identification with a particular ethnic group, a particular racial group. Islam is a little more free than that. Christianity is a Catholic by contrast with, say, Judaism and Islam. And it's very, very important to understand. Now, we said that a couple of implications for models. We said, for example, a local-minded church is challenged by this attribute. A local-minded church, that is a church that's not mission-minded. It's great that we've got the term running around now, I don't know who coined it, the idea that a Christian has to be a world Christian. Who came up with that? Who originally came up with that idea? Start using that term. Be a world Christian. Maybe. That's as good a probably. But anyway, what he, in a sense, he is in. Why is what he is doing there? Why does it ring a bell? Why is it successful? Why does it help churches? Why does it revitalize people? You can get a lot of renewal going in the church through stressing being a world Christian. He's invoking Catholicity at that point, and a local-minded church, a church that's not missions-minded, is challenged. And we also said another example probably would be. Oh, let's looking around here. Obviously, we're talking about racism or classism, and we discussed that at some day. And just a refusal to really welcome or care or believe that Christianity incarnated in other classes and other ethnic groups and other nationalities and cultures is really as valid as ours, and that is that. Churches or mindsets like that are judged by the attribute of Catholicity. I guess the thing that is that can really get you going is to consider how many places in the Bible talks about different images of the church. For example, the family of God. We're the family of God. We're the kingdom of Christ. That is, we're citizens of a kingdom. We're the people of God. And you realize that every one of those images is talking about Catholicity. See, for example, your primary ethnic group is the Christian race because we're the people of God. Your primary social class is the church because there's neither slave nor free there, you see. We're all slaves of Christ, and we're all kings, too. Yeah, you see. So your primary social class is the church. Your primary ethnic group is the church. Your primary family is the church because we're the family of God. See? Your primary national linkage, your primary nationality is that you're members of the Commonwealth, you're citizens of the kingdom, you're citizens of heaven. And so it's really quite fair and right to say, if you understand Catholicity, you are a Christian first and you are an American second. You are a Christian first and you're black or you're white second. You're a Christian first and you're a member of this clan or this family second. You see. You're a Christian first and you're a professional or a ditch digger second. And that's Catholicity. Now, very, very closely linked, as you're going to see, and we already that's my summary of what we went over last time. Now, let me get into unity, and we can discuss them together, because they really come together. When it comes to the attribute of unity, which is closely allied, I think we're talking here, of course, about oneness, and the implications are both organizational and organic. Again, when we talk about the unity of the body, the unity of the church, we're talking about both that this attribute must express itself both organizationally and organically. Now, by organizationally, I began to talk a little bit about this at the end of last meeting. A big part of discussion when we come to the unity of the church is to discuss what are denominations anyway, and I'm going to. Give you a line that I think a lot of other folks at this school will give you as well. That the Bible teaches the unity of the church, and therefore the Bible does not ever envision denominations. And because it doesn't envision, it doesn't provide for denominations. Let's just say, first of all, in a very negative way, there's no denomination then that can really, really, really just consider itself the church. Every denomination, in a sense, is a sub-church or even a parachurch organization. Now, we have to be very careful about this, because when you think of parachurch organizations, you think of organizations which don't have discipline, they don't have the sacraments, because they don't have special officers. If you were here last Friday, and I know a lot of you weren't here last Friday, but that's all right, you can get the tape from somebody. If you were here last Friday, Harvey Kahn talked about Abraham Kuyper's ecclesiology, and he explained that Kuyper understood that the church was more than just the institutional church in which the special officers preach the word, celebrate the sacraments, and administer discipline. He said the church also goes into every area of life. It goes into politics, it goes into science, it goes actually in groups. Christians go out there in groups, but in that case, they're exercising the general office of believer. That's something we're going to talk about later on anyway, under ministry, later on in this course. But they're exercising the general office of believer. They are the church. It's not to say because they're not meeting for the Lord's Supper and so on that they are not the church. They are the church, you see. They're not the institutional church. Now, in the same way, when we talk about the unity of the church, we're saying that, I would say, that a church that has that is unity-minded recognizes other parachurch organizations, recognizes other congregations, recognizes other denominations as part of the church, and that you are part of them. And I guess I'm already getting into this, implications for models. The unity attribute judges, first of all, separatism. Separatism. I always misspell that. My English teacher told me there is a rat in separate, and that's the way I remember. Huh? Did you know there's a rat in separate rather than a red? If you have a rat, it's not separate. Okay. Anyway, I mentioned to you, for example, that if you ever get a chance to hear Bill Crispin give you his pilgrimage as an urban minister, he will tell you that, like many Reformed Anglo folks, they looked at the city as being absolutely barren of any kind of vital religion. And when he went in to be a church planter, he spent a pretty good amount of time assuming that he was all by himself, until he began to realize the church was full of all sorts of forms of Christianity which he didn't have the spectacles to recognize. And to a great degree, if you listen to him talk about the pilgrimage, he would recognize that the problem with his model, you see, he had a model, and he was looking through that model, we talked about this before, spectacles, he was looking through the model at the city of Philadelphia, and his model, the spectacles, filtered out all kinds of things that were there. Filtered out meaning he didn't see all kinds of things that were there, because they weren't the right denomination, because they didn't have the same kind of theology, because the people worshipped in different ways, and because his model didn't have a good understanding of the attribute of the unity of the church, he wasn't seeing things. And as a result, we have to say that a church that's a separatistic church doesn't make any effort to see parachurch organizations, doesn't make any effort to see other congregations of other denominations, is really part of the church. It doesn't reach out. It doesn't work to cooperate as far as possible. Now listen, let me just say something briefly in a positive way about denominations. Some people have said, and I'm not a historian, some people have said that maybe the 17th century Puritans are probably the fathers of modern denominationalism. And the way the Puritans went into denominationalism was really a very positive thing. They looked and they worked and they worked and they worked, you see. The Puritans worked and worked at staying within one body. They worked to stay within the Church of England. At a certain point, they were expelled. And their attitude toward denominations was this: we have convictions. We have convictions over how to do discipline, over how to baptize people and so forth. And therefore, because we have convictions, we have to at some point separate with our brothers. When we come to baptize folks, if you believe in baptizing infants and we do not believe in baptizing infants, that when we meet together as a church to baptize people, we're going to have to meet across the street from each other. You see. In other words, we're going to have to separate at that point, and only to that extent. But in all sorts of other things, we obviously would work together. See, we only are as separate from one another as we have to be because of certain convictions that we don't want to give up. And therefore, we reach out and cooperate in every way except to the place where we're forced by our convictions to be apart. Now, that's a pretty interesting approach. Therefore, if you would say to a Puritan, "I'm interdenominational," they'd say, "Oh, you have no convictions." In fact, I think the Puritans would say the only interdenominational Christians are brand new Christians who haven't really begun to decide, well, what does the Bible say about all these issues that we have to decide about? And as soon as you begin to come to any convictions, you begin to realize that there's a regrettable but unavoidable separation necessary to the degree you have convictions. If you would say to a 17th century Puritan, "I'm non-denominational," they would say, "Oh, you're a cult." You see. Now, you see why there's both a positive way of looking at denominations. We can say denominations are a sin, but we can also say that we're all participating in sin in the most sincere way possible. We know we're sinful because if you read John Murray on the sanctity of truth in his book, principles of conduct. I think he's very biblical. He says that even when you're unwittingly propagating error, you are participating in sin. It's something that you can't avoid. You're doing your very best, and you have to be constantly going about with your denominational approaches, with your convictions, with the deepest humility. Because you have to do, you know, somebody, I haven't found where the quote is. I know R.C. Sproul used to always quote this, and I haven't found it yet. He doesn't know where it is either. He says that John Calvin said, nobody's got more than about four-fifths of the theology right anyway. And, you know, I keep thinking, does that mean one of the 5 points of Calvinism is wrong? what it does mean is you don't know where your 20%, and that's only the best of us, right? You don't know where your 20% of error is. And so when you separate to the degree, you have to separate just to go about doing the things that God commands you to do, like to baptize people or to exercise discipline and so forth, to ordain people and so forth. We separate with humility and with a clear eye that this is something we're all participating in, this denominationalism. But we have to do it. We have to care about our convictions. At the same time, we have to recognize the unity to the greatest degree possible, organizationally, in cooperation, in working together, and so on. Yeah,
correct. The only problem at times is when we sort of rest it in that and say, well, it's always going to be like this. There's nothing we can do about it. This is the best we can do. As a Presbyterian, my job, I've been convinced and committed to the unity of the church, say this in all humility. To my brothers who disagree with us on baptism is to try to convince them of their error and in their separation from the Catholic tradition and their separation from biblical teaching and to bring them into the church. Now, the thing is, they're saying to me the same thing. The thing we've got to recognize, if some of us in here are paedo-Baptists and some of us aren't, one of us is wrong. We can't leave it at, well, you have your convictions, I have mine, let's be comfortable with that, because one of us is unbiblical. And we need to be lovingly and gently.
And we know who it is. No, I got you.
I recognize you're Christians, but...
Yeah, I'll come back to this in a moment. But what Craig is trying to say, which is very important, we all know, and that is, is that there are plenty of efforts at Catholicity and unity that absolutely disregard holiness and apostolicity. In other words, there's folks that, if you're trying to graph this again, and we'll come back to this in just a minute and think of this in a moment, there are all kinds of people that are trying to get out here, and they find, let me tell you, if you're trying to work out in this direction toward more Catholicity, you'll find that the way of least resistance is to go that way. Right? Obviously. There's no doubt about it. The less we talk about our convictions, the easier it seems to be to start to work together. And in fact, even evangelicals recognize the fact that if Baptists and Presbyterians and Methodists who are evangelical, for example, they all share a common conviction. In other words, you're talking about apostolicity there, the gospel, you have to be regenerated. You get together to do some sort of outreach in the community. Maybe you get together on a particular project to work together. You'll find that even immediately you feel in a way that I better not bring up anything where we differ. And maybe at first that's probably true, but real fellowship speaks the truth in love and is willing to talk about things. And of course, in the extreme cases, and that is what we call the modern ecumenical movement, the whole idea is you just stay away from talking about this stuff if we're going to get Catholicity. We can talk about this in a minute. But that was Craig is trying to say, is you have to really, you can't work on one attribute in isolation from the others. And that's the rub. Well, and I'll say one more thing, going along with what Craig says. We have got to remember that we're not working just in organic union, a spiritual union, but we do work at organizational union. That means, for example, that congregations that are like-minded should try to merge with one another, or at least connect as much as possible, all right? It means that we have to network, we have to work for union, and we have to make sure that the unity of the body is more than just so-called spiritual unity. Because, frankly, when Jesus Christ prays that they might be one even as we are one, and if you ever heard Ed Clowney expound on that, there's no way that when Jesus is talking about the Trinity, that we can say the Trinity, the persons of the Trinity are just spiritually one, but they're not organizationally one. Of course, they're one, one, one. And in the same way, that prayer for the unity of the church just cannot be dismissed by saying, oh yeah, every so often I call the pastor across town and ask how things are. that there does need to be a whole lot more work at the organizational unity. And so separatism is a mindset, and obviously unity judges that. Let me just say organic unity is... By organic unity, we mean that you have to be working at unity of life that comes from apostolicity and holiness. That's what I was trying to do down here. Let me see if I can get it to you. Martin Lloyd-Jones has an interesting way of looking at the place in the Old Testament that says that when the temple was being built, all of the stones had to be shaped at the quarry. You were not allowed to bring the stones to the building site and shape them. They had to be shaped at the quarry so that when the temple was actually being built up, there was not a sound of chisel or hammer. There was no cacophony. There was no strife, you see. And it was supposed to be built up in silence, that when the stones came together, they already fit because of what happened to them at the quarry. Now, I know that this is not what the people who wrote about this meant. Lloyd-Jones is right in saying he's reminded, not necessarily taught by that illustration, he's reminded that the Bible says very much the same thing about the church, that the church is not supposed to be a place where there's strife. It's not supposed to be the place where there's noise, in a sense, but it's supposed to be a place where there's peace and harmony. Why? Because it's something that's already happened to us. The Bible says in Ephesians 4:3, we are to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. It doesn't say attain the unity. You see, there's a unity that's already there, and that we simply have to keep it up. We're a maintenance crew. We're not a construction crew. And what Lloyd-Jones goes on to say at that point is, what happened to us at the quarry? If you were convicted by sin, and if you've received the righteousness of Christ, that gives you a radically different way of looking at life and at yourself. And people who have been affected by that, you know, at their roots, can come together and fit. And no other human beings can fit, certainly not across racial and family and national lines, you see. And he says, we have to recognize that unity is already there and we can't do anything about it. Then he turns his guns on the ecumenical movement. And he says, what the ecumenical movement tries to do is hammer out unity by watering down the apostolicity and the holiness. He says, the unity of the church is not something you can hammer out. The unity of the church is something that hammers you out, you see. That by that it means what has happened to you creates a unity, and it's your job to maintain it, not obtain it. There's an interesting place in Ephesians 1:15, where Paul says to the people that he's writing to, I know you're in Christ because of your love for Jesus, you know Jesus, and for your love for all the saints. For all the saints. Lloyd-Jones at that point says that is a very, very important test of the reality of your Christian faith. He says, do you love all the saints? All the saints. And now you're talking about both Catholicity and unity. And what he does is he tells this interesting story. He says, in his earlier days of being a Christian, very often the devil would come to accuse him and would say, what makes you really think you're a Christian? Aren't you kidding yourself? Maybe it's just a psychological experience. How do you know that? And Lloyd-Jones tells the story that he would take this text reminded him of this incident. He was a doctor, as you know, in the early days of the 20th century. He was, I don't know if he was a heart specialist or something, but he had a very, very fine job. And he heard the call of the ministry, and he went into the ministry, left medicine. And if I remember correctly, though I can't give you the figures, I remember adding it up and realizing that when he took that little church in Wales, he took something like a 90% salary cut. I remember seeing the kind of poundage that he was making at his job in medicine and the amount of money he got as an evangelist. Evangelists in mission churches were paid far less than pastors in established churches because usually evangelists in mission churches were not ordained seminary-trained men. And so he took this incredible cut. And as far as I can see, Britain is pretty much more class-conscious even than the country I'm here in, that is America. And Lloyd-Jones, though, when he was accused by the devil, he would turn to the devil, he said, and he would say, well, here's something you can't explain. And that is, why is it that I would rather spend 2 hours talking about Jesus with the lowest fisherwoman, you know, the lowest little uneducated Christian fisherwoman, who smells and who has no is illiterate. I would rather spend 2 hours in fellowship with her than I would with someone from my own class, my own social class, my own standing, my own rank, you see, talking with them who's not a Christian about things that I should have everything in common with. Yeah, I should have everything in common with them. I would rather spend time with these people, you see. Or I remember Addison Leach, who was my professor at Gordon Conwell. He says he often would listen on the radio to people, you know, people who are preaching on the radio, and the guys were jerks. They knew very little about doctrine. Their hearts were right, but they were saying all kinds of very strange things, all kinds of very odd things, all kinds of very erroneous things, all kinds of very obnoxious things. And through it all, you could listen. Here's a person who's really a believer, you know, just headed in the wrong direction. Addison Leach had a PhD from Oxford and so on. And he used to say, I just have never, what's really odd is what he hangs around with the people from Harvard and Yale in the divinity schools, many of whom he considered to be unbelievers. And I'm just telling you what he said. I don't know the people in those divinity schools. He said people from his social class and standing, and then after he would be at one of these societies or theological societies, he would then drive home and listen to the guys on the radio, and he would say, you know, I realize the Lord would speak to my heart and say, these are my people, you see. I'm on the side of the dummies. You see, these folks are mine. I feel more at home with them, and I can relate to them and deal with them better than the people from my social class and educational rank. And Lloyd-Jones was saying, I would turn to the devil and I would say that. I love all the saints, no matter who they are, no matter how different they are, I feel more of a union with them than anybody else. And he said the devil would never have anything to say. And so that's the way the devil would say, yep, you're right. I don't know what to say. And he'd run away. And what was Lloyd-Jones doing was he's invoking the attribute of the unity. Yeah, Alan.
I think part of
the
sermon I heard preached, holding those things in tension, the apostolicity of the Catholic.
Yeah.
Is that sermon by Lloyd-Jones? I don't really know if it's given out in Florida or...
Might have been the same sermon. What is it?
Was it the one on Hebrews 10? Is that the one you're talking about?
No.
He's preaching the same thing. He takes the text, you know, the call to prayer that you find there in the 27th. First, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and full assurance. Mm-hmm. He takes that and he says, you know, this is the call of the ecumenical aspect of prayer. Let's lay aside all our differences and pray.
Mm-hmm.
The text says, before that, let us hold unswervingly to the hope of the best.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, how can we draw near in full assurance with those who do not hold fast to the same hope? And he said, you can't minimize the fact that people don't believe the gospel.
That's right.
Say, let's pray with them.
It's the same sermon I heard, just a different text.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right, I know. By the way, you'll find that out. You get into preaching and you preach 3 times a week. You know, I have 1,600 sermons in my file from 10 years in Virginia, but really, there's about 20 sermons in there. from about 80 different texts. Okay, let me... that's what I figured. I think 20 is pretty good to come up with. So anyway, if you come up with about 30 in your lifetime, I mean, 30 really different things to say, you're in pretty good shape. There's only so many things in there, you know. Okay. You remember that last time I talked to you about four areas that I'm going to talk to you at greater length in, four models of ministry that I'm going to talk to you about next week in detail. I called them live orthodoxy, what else, dead orthodoxy, heterodoxy, which is what you call liberalism, but that's a pretty unfair and term in some ways, for a lot of reasons, inappropriate. But anyway, heterodoxy, live orthodoxy, dead orthodoxy, and what?
Enthusiasm.
I can't come up with a better word for it. I know it's an old English word, but emotionalism, so on. When it comes to, when you try to use these all four of these attributes and try to test different kinds of models, again, what you've got out here with a strong emphasis both on apostolicity, holiness, and Catholicity and unity is live orthodoxy. And there is just no doubt, if you read the history of revivals, there is no doubt that there, during the history of revivals, when all the churches of all the different denominations are revived and renewed, it's mighty hard to tell them apart in many ways. And at the even when it was easy, even when you had a controversy like Whitfield and Wesley over Arminianism and Calvinism, you, in spite of the fact that very often the followers of those leaders still, you know, would get up their dukes with one another. There was a remarkable amount of cross-pollination and so on. And the attitude of the leaders was very different. There's a place where Whitfield was talking to some young fans, and one of the young fans had made some incredible statement to George Whitfield about saying, I don't suppose we'll see Mr. Wesley up there in heaven. And because I think Whitfield was talking about the fact that Calvinism was the gospel. And Whitfield was talking about the fact that to really not believe in the sovereignty of grace gets you into the area of works righteousness and so forth. All right. And as soon as somebody brought up their hand and said, I don't suppose we'll see Mr. Wesley up in heaven, Whitfield says, no, you're probably right. He'll be so close to the throne up there, and we'll be way back somewhere that we probably very seldom even bump into him. And the attitude was a very Catholic attitude, you see. And whenever you have that live orthodoxy, you have this tremendous Catholicity and unity between all the churches in the town. They all get revived. They start to have their meetings up on the hill together, you know, and everybody takes turns in preaching and so forth. Not a minimizing or a removal of doctrinal distinctives, but very often you'll find a lot of meeting of the minds on doctrinal issues, too. Down here, that is, lots of emphasis on Catholicity and unity, and little or no emphasis, in fact, down here, you know, you can keep going, is what we call some forms of heterodoxy, especially big parts of what we might call the ecumenical movement. That doesn't mean I don't think the word ecumenical is a bad word. I'm really sorry that I think liberal is a wonderful word too. Liberal means generous. Ecumenical means, you know, Catholic. And so I hate to even use the words, but if I don't use them, you won't even know what I'm talking about to a certain degree. There's there's the folks who say, let's get rid of any doctrinal distinctives, let's get rid of apostolicity and holiness, get rid of discipline, you see. So get rid of confessions and get rid of disciplines so that we can have Catholicity and unity. Only trouble is when you all get together, this is what's so funny, if you get rid of theology and if you get rid of discipline, now we're all together, what do? We can all hug and kiss each other, but as soon as we have no idea, because you see, theology and holiness gives you purpose. Yeah. I would say up here, up in this direction, that is, lots of emphasis on holiness apostolicity, but very little emphasis on Catholicity. You've got certain forms of enthusiasm and certainly dead orthodoxy. Okay, you have dead orthodoxy for sure here, and some kinds of emotionalism. That is, what I mean is the... Oh, again, my problem is I read too many old books, so I don't have good modern words. You know what censoriousness is? Sure, it's a mindset that everybody's wrong but me. And very often, when... you see it actually very often, not so much in a whole church, but you see it very often in a brand new believer. I would say a third, you know, a quarter to a third of all the people that have had really neat, thoroughgoing, sound conversion experiences, almost the first thing that happens to them is they begin to get very, very, they start to look down their nose at everybody else, people who don't have the right beliefs. In fact, they start looking down their nose at everybody else in the congregation that's not as excited about the gospel as they are, which is just about everybody. And one of the hardest things is for you as a minister to somehow get the guy to get rid of his narrow-mindedness without getting rid of his enthusiasm. And very hard, very important part of being a good minister is following up those kinds of new converts. But very often you get a whole movement like that, whole churches like that. And I certainly have seen some wonderful charismatic churches, some wonderful movements, lots of people coming to Christ who become very, very sectarian very quickly because of that very thing. Alan?
Well, isn't that special? But I mean, isn't that the caricature of Christians? I mean, you know, yes. A church lady. I mean, that's censorious, you know.
And that's the image the world has.
You stay up that late on Saturday night? Yeah, usually the church lady comes on. You know, usually the church lady comes on the Sabbath. Usually is when she comes on, like quarter after 12.
Right, right. So, yeah, and then Ferguson House on the TV. The TV automatically cuts off.
Agreed. Okay. Now, so when I say some kinds of enthusiasm down here, yes. Pardon me. The tape's on. Somebody's. Okay. Down here, I know the tape's on. Actually, there's always a tape on somewhere. always a tape on. Down here, I would say, and this is a hard one, when you have folks that really have, they're not concerned about doctrine, and they're not concerned that much about Catholicity either. There's some forms of heterodoxy. There's some sorts of very, very, very dead churches, that's all I could say. And there's even some forms of the enthusiasm where folks actually get into almost becoming, they get into all kinds of crazy doctrines, you see. In their life and in their enthusiasm, they get into crazy doctrines and get kind of cultic, okay? And so they're moving away from apostolicity and holiness. They're moving into perversions and at least eccentricities, if not perversions of doctrine. And so, in a lot of ways, again, you can use these attributes to test models and to understand drifts and so forth. Alrighty, questions at this point. I got enough time maybe to talk about something else. Any other questions or comments in general on our attributes? See, apostolicity, holiness, Catholicity, and unity. They're pretty all embracing generally. Okay, start here. Yeah.
You mentioned that different denominations might have rather particular beliefs, and then beyond that, you have unity. But why would you want to necessarily draw the line at denominations? Because some denominations have leeway. This is very non-reformed, but not according to the Reformed tradition anyway. But some denominations have much leeway, so that individual churches differ. And then some churches even have individual local church will allow leeway.
Yeah.
And so I don't see why, isn't it a bit arbitrary to draw the line at denominations?
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. No, I agree. I say even within denominations, there's got to be an expression of Catholicity. It's mighty. I won't draw the line at denominations. I agree with you. The hardest problem is keeping the apostolicity and Catholicity together within the denomination too. See, for example, there's denominations that can define. Well, I mean, let's talk about Reformed denominations, since a lot of you are involved and I know a lot about them. There's 5-point Calvinism, there's 10-point Calvinism, there's 15-point Calvinism, there's 20-point Calvinism. You understand? And the more points you decide you have to have in order for you to be a member of our denomination, the smaller the denomination gets, the more separate it gets. Now, the great danger is, in the interest of numbers, we have no points, you see. I already said that that's always a great danger. The real question, I wouldn't draw the line when it comes to expressing unity. I wouldn't draw the line at denominations. The real difficulty is, within a denomination, how do you make sure that you're Catholic enough so that you really have a great diversity of folks who all assent to the most essential parts of the Reformed faith, say, and where do you get to the place where you've allowed so much diversity that you spend all your time fighting over things? The fact is that a church that never has a fight at all probably isn't very Catholic. Everybody's exactly the same. Churches that are fighting all the time might begin to say, maybe we need two denominations in the interest of, in the proper way, just the way the Puritans first saw it. Because in order for us to really function and get the jobs done, maybe we need to separate just to the point that we have to. That's the real difficulty, is where to get that balance of apostolicity and Catholicity within a denomination. But I would agree with you that we have to express it within the denomination. We do. So I wouldn't draw a line there.
I was thinking more along the lines of just the apostolicity, just focusing in on that. Because in Canada, the Reformed tradition used to be carried on chiefly, I think, through the Presbyterian Church of Canada.
Yeah.
And that went downhill with some of the other mainline denominations. So that the Reformed tradition in Canada is largely interdenominational. You have people from different denominations who kind of get together and affirm each other. That's the way the Reformed tradition is really alive in Canada. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure that even within doctrinal reasons that you can limit it.
No.
I think we're in that pattern that we think denominations are going to be
I want to say that we need to have organizational unity across denominations. I want to say that. that we need, when we see someone in another denomination, and we both need to be in two denominations, but we can unite for all sorts of other things, we need to unite and do it and express that organization. I want to say that. I agree with you. Okay, Ben, I saw several hands. I want to get to them all. Go ahead.
Are there any implications for models set up as opposites? You seem to be opposite, like under Catholicity, universality is geographical and social. The implication for models, local minds, races, and classes, are those opposites?
No, I don't think necessarily. I wasn't trying to think of it like that. The opposite, no. You could be local-minded and racist at the same time. And I know this. You can be world Christian-minded and racist. As a matter of fact, it's very, very easy to be really big on foreign missions and be a racist church. You all know that we have no problem with planting churches in Uganda, but we might get upset if a black family comes into our congregation. So it's obvious that you could be geographically minded and a racist, or you could be not geographically minded or not socially minded. So they're not opposites, no. You can have all kinds of different permutations of errors.
Okay. One of the distinctions I don't understand, under holiness, apostolicity, oneness, and Catholicity. Mm. What's the difference between Catholicity and oneness? One a physical structure as opposed to spiritual?
Yeah, when I start looking at holiness and apostolicity too long, they start to merge. When I start to look at unity and Catholicity real long, they tend to merge too. I'm trying to say they're not all that separate. Unity has more to say with how Christians relate to one another. Catholicity has more to say with how Christians are to be relating to different cultures. And Catholicity has more to say about how we relate to the world. And unity has more to say with how we relate to one another. Catholicity says, don't withdraw from the world, don't withdraw from certain social classes and so forth. Unity says, don't withdraw from other believers. But if you press far enough, when you press far enough, basically they start to come together.
Any distinctions on holiness?
Well, apostolicity has more to do with doctrine, and holiness has more to do with practice. But the fact is, when you do church discipline, and church discipline was under holiness. Remember we talked about that last time? When you do church discipline, you're doing discipline on the basis not only of practice, but also on the basis of belief. So you can't pull them too far apart.
Okay,
got it. Okay, then David?
Well, maybe just the thought that they perhaps are two sides of one coin. The apostolicity and holiness may be the objective, subjective side
right.
of one truth, and Catholicism is maybe the objective, subjective.
Right. Good, okay. Absolutely. Bob, you still want to say something? You had a hand before.
We have the marks of the church now, the attributes of the church.
Yeah.
Why can't you decide if the Roman Catholic Church is the church?
Yeah, and we got all these different tests, right? You do it. Okay, Bob? I need somebody to lecture for me on November the 7th, and you can tell me. The trouble is, see, here's the marks, right? The marks are the Word, the sacraments, discipline. And remember, Clowney talks about ministries as being worship, edification, witness. They all come in together here. Here you have apostolicity and holiness and Catholicity and unity. And, they're actually, these are not three different columns. Because the mark of the Word certainly has a lot to do with apostolicity, right? Sacraments has a lot to do with holiness. Discipline has a lot to do with, my goodness, both of these. Worship has to do maybe more with holiness than any other place. Edification has to do with both the teaching and the unity. I mean, that's how you build people up. Witness has a lot to do with Catholicity, but I suppose it might have to do with everything. In a sense, you really could put all these things together and come up with four or five or six tests. The real problem is not knowing how many tests there are. Bob, the real problem is then how do you actually test the Roman Catholic Church? Do you test the Council of Trent? Is that the Roman Catholic Church? Do you test every single congregation? Do you have to go, from congregation to congregation and say, okay, of the 5 million congregations, 4 million are apostate, 1 million are the true church, And then we have to decide statistically. If a majority of the churches are true churches, therefore is a true denomination. The real question is at what level do you test the organic, the organizational? One of the problems we have is what do you decide to test? If you test the Council of Trent, there's almost no doubt that you've got a non-true church. If you test certain things like that, you say this is not a true church. But you may test the church across the street, which has become—it's been renewed through the charismatic movement. And the priest, when you sit down and talk to him, it says, "Yeah, I believe in justification by faith. Yeah, I suppose it's really not what the Council of Trent believes. But you know, who cares what the Council of Trent believes? We're given a whole lot of freedom, and I still respect the apostolic tradition." And so you sit down, you talk to this guy, and you say, "This guy has got what I would call eccentricities of doctrine. This guy's a believer." And his church is full of believers. And though I'd love to see them build up in the faith in more sound ways, in some places they're ministering, they're leading people to Christ. Now what do I do? Do I say that by definition, because you're part of a Roman Catholic Church, therefore, since some official statements indicate that the Catholic Church isn't a true church, therefore you're not a true church? The real problem is not the tests as much as it is how to administer them. And that's why it's hard to say. And that's, here's one more thing. That's why, and this is fair, it's good that in, say, for example, a denomination like the PCA, we never, ever, ever have told sessions, that is bodies of elders, that when a person comes from this or that or this or that church, you can receive their baptism or you have to rebaptize them. You can receive their ordination credentials or you have to reordain them. We have never told presbyteries who they have to reordain and who not. We've never told sessions who they have to rebaptize and who not. We say that is up for you as elders to sit together, take the test of the church, and decide in humility, since you probably know that it's very possible you're wrong, in humility, who you think are true churches and who you are, and who you don't think are true churches. And I think that is a very Catholic attitude, rather than, say, a denomination making this blanket statement, here's the list. We've got column A and column B, you know, and the true churches and the untrue churches. I think it's much better to leave it in many ways to individual congregations to use the tests. We got a few hands, do we? All right, well, let's see. Let's get them all. Bob, you've had your hand for a while. Go ahead.
You already mentioned about how you can't, like, make blanket generalizations about
that. Right.
But I'd like to hammer out some, in my mind, some guidelines.
Okay.
How we can associate with people outside of the Reformed faith. Like, for instance, if you were a pastor, would you invite someone who's evangelical but not really Reformed, like a muddle-headed Calvinist, preach in your pulpit?
Mm-hmm. You're asking me?
Yeah. Like, I'm just for a hypothetical thing.
Depends on the purpose. I know I've had missionaries preach in my pulpit who were certainly muddle-headed about Calvinism, but it never, you know, it didn't affect, as far as what I can tell, the preaching. See, because of my understanding of Calvinism, since I think Calvinism is the most consistent, but not perfect, the most consistent form of understanding the Bible, I think that all the Arminians who are real Christians are very inconsistent, that they smuggle all kinds of good stuff in that they don't have a basis for. That they may have, Arminianism is more of an intellectual mistake, and generally, you know, I would say an Arminian is always, because I believe I'm right. You see, I'm very charitable because I know Arminians, when they preach, when they minister, and all that, they're going to be constantly being inconsistent. They're going to be ministering and praying in ways consistent with Calvinism, and so I'm not afraid, usually, especially for the godly folks that I know who aren't Calvinists, to have them preach in my pulpit. And I've certainly had missionaries preach who are, you know, we're not Calvinists, but I could tell that would not muddy. I mean, they were muddle-headed when I asked them, but it didn't mean that they were muddle-headed preachers and that they were going to preach an unsound word. But you just asked me, and I'm on tape. Thanks, Bob. A whole world will know that. Somebody will haul me up on something on that. But anyway, that's how I think that's a Catholic spirit. It's also pretty interesting to see how, I can't take too long on every question. That's a great question.
Let's see. Know as a standing order.
Yeah, Dick Canola. Ricky.
When you were talking about accepting priest so-and-so because he has these eccentricities of doctrine.
Yeah.
Now, but because it's rung a bell in some congregation, you know, Catholicity.
Yeah, Catholicity, right.
But we have churches which are from the charismatic movement and all that, you know, Roman Catholic. The problem is how we would accept those eccentricities of doctrine, because sometimes they say, oh yeah, we believe in justification by faith and blah, 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 and, you know. But we should be careful in knowing what they're really meaning.
Yes.
And that, you know, not just accepting, well, we say this, but what's the root of their belief?
I agree. And it's the apostolicity which says, here's what we believe, should go along with holiness, which means here's how we hold people accountable. Yeah. And it's one thing to say we believe in justification by faith, but their people are all full, I mean, the people are in bondage to all sorts of superstitious beliefs. And the church isn't doing anything to hold them accountable about that. And that's where holiness, as far as I know, is holding people accountable. It's a big part of it. And again, you have to use both the test of apostolicity and holiness to see. At the very least, you know, going back to Bob's question, I do know that the attributes can certainly tell you all kinds of things about the health of a church. The problem is, when does the church have a terminal? When is it dead, or when is it just? It's very hard to tell a dead person from somebody who's just about dead. And I do know that even though it's difficult to draw lines like that, these things can tell you a great deal about the health of a church. I think they can tell you whether a church is revived or not. Okay, I'm missing hands. George, and then Scott, go ahead.
You've been talking, making references from time to time about organizational unity from the initial line.
Yeah.
It seems real theoretical, as nice as that would seem to be.
Well,
and that would also seem to be include discipline as well. It's not just events. You know, all these marks that we've described for a little 2A denominational church. How would you go about doing that? Would that be, so to speak, Presbyterian in function?
Yeah, very often that's what happens. You not only do you have fellowships in which there's some organizational unity across denominational lines, you can even have more informal kinds of discipline and so forth as much as possible. You know, in Gordon MacDonald, he said this publicly, the way in which he carried out discipline with himself was he actually set up a small board of Christian leaders who he then submitted himself to. He said, here's what, now they're not, they weren't in the same denomination. He said, here's what I've done. I want you then to deal with me. I will submit myself to you. You tell me what I have to do to rectify things, to put myself right and so forth and so on. And what he was doing at that point was doing, I was pretty good. He was in an independent church situation, which I think is a little difficult, but he was in a way forced to do something there. But he was able to have a kind of discipline. It didn't have any formal sanctions to it, but he was actually expressing that unity across those denominational lines, and I'm glad he did it. I think the way in which he's handled what happened to him is really pretty instructive.